Welcome, welcome. We are back for another episode of The Lock-In, sponsored by the dashing and discerning people over at Poker Stars and Paddy Power Poker. I'm David Lappin alongside Dara O'Kearney. Dara, I've been following your Instagram stories this past fortnight or so. You are an ultra marathon runner reduced to walking. You're like a 500 big blind cash game hold'em specialist reduced to playing limit hold'em right now, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm making no pretense that I'm enjoying it either. I mean, people make great claims for walking that it's a wonderful activity. It's not. It's incredibly boring. It's just a really slow, crap version of running. I can't believe that people actually do this for fun, but I have no other choice at the moment. You know, as probably most people know at this stage, I dislocated my shoulder just before the Irish Open and actually fractured it as well. And the first question I asked the specialist when he told me I had a fracture was, can I run? And he looked at me like I was absolutely crazy. And he was like, you have a fracture, you can't run. So yeah, walking, we're trying to get through this next few weeks and before I can get back to running, but it hasn't been fun.
Yeah, for anyone who just loves watching or listening to Dara be miserable, definitely check out those Instagram stories. They're quite funny, but they are of a sad man who clearly doesn't want to get his daily exercise. Dara, one final thing before we introduce this week's guest. You also have a bit of personal news. You have, I believe we could phrase it as rekindled an old flame. Do you want to tell us about that?
My deal as an ambassador for the Irish Poker Tour expired a couple of months ago. Didn't renew at the time for a variety of reasons, but have just renewed now. So I'm once again an IPT ambassador, starting at the Monster this weekend. The Monster satellites have been running on Paddy Power pretty much every evening. Haven't actually managed to win a satellite yet, which is kind of
what?
It's hilarious to me that this is. I mean, the poker universe is finding so many ways to just make fun of me at the moment. You know, ultra runner reduced to walking. I had all those bullets at the Irish Open that I just fired through and, you know, barely got a cash at the festival. And now I'm not even able to satellite into a much smaller event. But yeah, it's on the green all this weekend. It's going to be a big one, as the name suggests, the Monster. And yeah, very happy to be back representing the Irish Poker Tour.
Yeah, and great that the Irish Poker Tour has that connection with Paddy Power Poker. Obviously, it's perfect for you. Joining us this week is a German poker player and content creator, a streamer, and now an EPT runner-up. A couple of months ago, he had a huge breakout performance in Paris. He is, of course, Felix Schneiders. Felix, welcome.
Hey, guys. I'm really happy to be on the show. Thank you for inviting me. That's really cool. So, yeah.
Oh, we're so glad to have you on, Felix. Felix, you started playing poker in 2005. Actually, that's before either Dara or I. Like a lot of other poker players, actually quite a few poker players of that day, you came from Magic the Gathering, I know. When you first got into poker, you managed to grind out your first five-figure bankroll within a couple of months from just a single $50 deposit, or at least that's what the lore suggests when you Google you. Quickly moving through all the different no-limit six-mash cash game levels, you just sort of like charged your way through. That feels like a story that is very of that time, by which I mean it's sort of rare nowadays for players to spin from a small deposit. Do you feel like the financial barrier to entry in poker today is higher because games used to be juicier? Or is it lower because there's so much strategy content out there and you can actually get quite good at poker without playing a single hand for money?
That's a very good question. Now that you just mentioned my sort of like whole poker vita, I'm walking through it in my mind again, trying to think of how it was like when I started out. I mean, the games were much juicier and softer. It was easy to make money back in the days in cash games. You just basically had to sit there, have a certain strategy, like in no limit hold'em, just basically flop a set, get aces, get kings in a three bet pot and stack somebody with top pair. And, you know, you just get money handed to you. It still happens, but it's much, much rarer. I haven't been in tune with cash games at all. So the past 10 years or so, I've been only grinding tournaments, started online and then switched to live poker. So I have no clue about cash games. I heard that it's sort of like gotten a little bit drier in that case, but when I was grinding back in the days, I always felt like no matter what happens, like the micro stakes, when you start in the micro stakes, they always stay the same. Like in live poker, you know, the learning curve is very small and there's people punting all over the place and not being patient. So I don't know what the games would be like, but I imagine that it would probably still be worthwhile to put in the work. Like back in the days, I just remember I was grinding endlessly. I was grinding for 12 hours straight during a day and just played my way through micro stakes, 2 cent, 4 cent, and then 5 cent, 10 cent. And then, I mean, I was really happy when I got to the point where I got my first grand as a bankroll, but it took me a couple months. And after that, it took me another 1 or 1.5 years to get to my first 5 digits. So I think it requires, I wouldn't say it requires like the games to be super soft, but it still requires a lot of stamina and a lot of like persistence, I would say. I was very willing to do it. I was very willing to sit on my ass and just grind all the tables that's necessary and put in the work. So I would say it's probably still the same, but on a different level.
Yeah, that makes an awful lot of sense. This may come as a shock now to people who are doing what we did before this interview began, which was admire your incredibly luscious, salubrious office there behind you. But when you first started streaming, you did so from your parents' basement. I often feel like the OG streamers from back then, you guys sort of saw the future in a big way at the beginning. Did you feel like you were at the frontier of something that would grow like it did? Or were you just kind of mucking about, kind of happy that this technology existed and thought, I'll give this a go?
I got to say, this is really good questions. Like get my brain working. Like I'm trying to think. I don't think when I started streaming that I was part of something big, to be honest. I was just basically just doing what I enjoyed. I was just thinking, oh, this is fun. I'm just going to hop on there, put the camera on, just don't care about the quality. I mean, my first YouTube video qualities was total shit. It was like basically really bad resolution. I didn't even care about the equipment. The microphone was really bad. And I sort of like did that because I just enjoyed it. I was already building a little following on YouTube. And then I saw there was people streaming. Then a friend of mine suggested, why don't you stream your sessions? And I was like, yeah, let's stream a session. Why not? And I was already doing some live training sessions at, back in the days, it was a poker school, IntelliPoker it was called, by PokerStars. And they basically just had like live training sessions where I was giving little lecture classes about like certain topics. And that was fun already. So streaming felt natural to me. I was just jumping into streaming and just thought I would enjoy this. And then I saw there's two other guys. There's like Jason Somerville and Jamie Staples back in the days. Those were the two that were doing the same thing. And I felt like we were just like basically just enjoying ourselves and shooting the shit and don't know where this goes. And all of a sudden you feel like, okay, you got 100 viewers. Well, actually this could turn into something bigger. And then you get to 200 viewers and then like the competitive drive kicks in and you think like, ah, we can make this work. We can make this into something bigger. So that's like the poker player drive that just kicked off, so to say.
Yeah, very cool. Very cool. Dara, we've talked about streaming, obviously, ever since this show began. I guess podcasting and streaming were the new forms of media coming up simultaneously a decade on. How do you feel about both in a poker context? I might be wrong, but it feels like we were both, you know, sort of like kicking off on our respective platforms. I think both saw big increases up to maybe like just after COVID or around that kind of period. That sort of lockdown period was obviously good for streams for obvious reasons. But now it feels, Dara, like there are fewer streamers and there are fewer poker podcasts. Do you think that's accurate?
Yeah, I think it is accurate. There's certainly way fewer poker podcasts. It seemed like almost everybody started a poker podcast during the pandemic because you know, what else were they going to do? Or they started streaming. And, you know, a lot of them didn't survive. But even, you know, a lot of the bigger poker podcasts have folded in the last period, you know, thinking of things like Only Friends, Chasing Poker Greatness. And that's, yeah, the podcast space has certainly shrunk. I've always kind of seen them as like the radio and late night TV of poker. Poker podcast is like radio and streaming is like late night TV. And they kind of serve or scratch different itches, I think, in my mind. Podcasting is sort of more aimed at maybe a general audience. Twitch streaming is aimed more sort of at a niche audience and one thing I've always felt about streaming, which is that, you know, a lot of focus has been made on, you know, people that got into poker through watching streaming. And that's undoubtedly true. There are people who are playing poker now because they started watching a Felix stream or a Spraggy stream or Jamie Staples stream or whoever back in the day. But I think A huge value streaming has is retention. You know, you get people in and now they're kind of hooked and they're in the poker space and it just becomes a habit. I think streaming is probably more habit forming in that sense than podcasting because, you know, we basically disappear and then come back every 2 weeks, whereas the streamers are out there in the streets 3 to 5 nights a week. People are just constantly watching them. And then, you know, I guess the more recent kid on the block are the poker vlogs and the live cash streams, but they all kind of fill the same thing of like poker has really struggled since 2011, getting sort of TV coverage. You know, all of the sponsors disappeared after 2011 because, you know, people say, oh, there used to be so much poker back on TV back in the day. But what they maybe don't realize is that pretty much all of that was paid for by the poker sites. You know, they were essentially paid advertisements for the sites. And then 2011 came along, suddenly America wasn't on the table anymore, and the sites just didn't see the same value in paying for these. So poker disappeared largely from mainstream TV. And ever since then, it has been struggling to try and get as much coverage as they can. And, you know, that's through a combination of social media, YouTube, Twitch, podcasting, all that stuff.
Yeah, indeed. Back to you, Felix. You joined PokerStars in 2014, and it was around about that time that you made your switch. You mentioned the switch from cash games over to tournaments. I think you did a memorable bankroll challenge, was like an $80 to 8K one early on. You went to the PSPC, which was obviously a very big thing. Stars were pushing, and then obviously had to get pushed back a little bit. But you know, that was a monster event that really captured the imagination, and I think also, you know, got a lot of attention on your streams and what you were doing with the coverage of that stuff over there. It's been quite the journey over, I guess, 2 decades for you in poker. It's all led you to Paris in a sense just a few short months ago. Understandably, streamers think in stories, by which I mean you're obviously depicting your own real life, but there's an understanding that the audience get more engaged by, how do I put this, like a plot that twists and turns, that thickens, and maybe most importantly drives towards something. If
Absolutely.
anything, you accentuate that because your grind team live stream your live play at events as well. That's actually a very unique selling point. There's not too many people doing that. With such a marquee result in Paris in March, is there a feeling for you that it was the happy ending of the movie? And has that strangely made it harder for you now to keep the story going?
Also, very good question. It's the third one. So yeah, to be honest, it has made it a little bit harder in my mind because even though I didn't finish the job, I didn't get the trophy yet. So this is still on the table and I still want to do it. It feels strangely like a big relief for sure, because it's been like a total of a 20-year journey that started in 2005, 2006 when I started with poker. I wasn't thinking that I would be sitting at the big TV tables one day. I was actually thinking like of becoming a big cash game pro back then. Then when I switched to tournaments, I still didn't think about getting the trophies. Only when I switched to live poker, I sort of like got the connection about the story towards the trophy. And then it grew on me that the trophy and the memorable moment would be the most important thing for what you say is the plot of the whole stream. Because people usually follow, as you correctly say, I think people follow for a story because they want to identify with the person that is doing it. So they probably want to use it as an outlet to live through the person, sort of like a dream or a sort of life that they're at the moment not able to live for whatever reason, like private, personal, or money-wise, or whatever, or skill-wise, because they're not there yet. So they want to have like. It's nice for them to have this outlet. Like we want to watch a movie. Like we go to a movie and we just feel with the person that is going through all the emotions. And I realized that this is actually the whole story of the stream that we're selling. And it also, because we've been talking with the team about this internally recently, because people sort of like we've tried to showcase the whole German community with the stream, and we sometimes switch the protagonists, so to say. But like it doesn't really get the same vibe and the same feel. So once we switch to a different protagonist, even though they have a really good deep run, it doesn't get the same traction that it gets when they follow me towards that, getting like one step closer to the trophy. And it just really struck me. I'm like, okay, I mean, we're doing the same thing with a different person. Why not follow this? It's super interesting. But it's not the person who started the whole journey that you've started the journey with, and you want to see this finished. So yeah, basically, the second place feels like the story has finally come to some sort of closure. but not really yet. I still want to do the trophy, but yeah, it's a very, very unique situation. I'm still in the process of trying to think what this makes of me and what this turns the stream into, or what this might potentially turn the stream into. So I don't have a real answer for the question, to be honest, because I don't really know yet. I haven't processed it. It hasn't grown on me yet.
Well, what I would say is spin-offs are difficult, as we can attest to. This is our spin-off show, and it was not an easy first few episodes. We certainly had to sort of figure out how we could do something that had our faces on it, because, you know, as I've said many times before, I think Dara and I both obviously have faces for radio because people seem to go towards our audio stuff more than YouTube. But, you know, we still wanted to make a YouTube show, and we still wanted to figure out how we could do it best. And Dara, actually, bring you back in on this, you know, like we felt a little bit of Felix's pains there. Obviously, it was the same people, but we were trying to do it in a different way. And that's always difficult, because I suppose audiences naturally just like get attracted to one thing and then they don't want change, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Like you can make the mistake of thinking that your audience is going to like absolutely everything you do. And I've found out the hard way that that is absolutely not the case. Anytime I start a new area or, you know, new type of content, I really don't know whether it's going to work or not. And sometimes I'm quite surprised by what does work and what doesn't work. We started Lock-In, as the name suggests, during the pandemic, because we weren't traveling anymore. And we thought, okay, well, we need to do something to compensate for the fact that people aren't seeing us at live stops. And that was the original idea. And it was going to be just the two of us talking, which was a terrible idea. And, you know, we found out after two shows that just wasn't going to work. The second episode did considerably worse than the first episode. And it was clear that if we persisted with this nonsense idea, we were going to be talking to ourselves and literally nobody watching before too long. So we had to start getting guests on, which again, like, it wasn't the concept. The original concept was sort of like, well, keep up what we were doing during the pandemic. Now you're not seeing us. But you sometimes have to accept that what you think is the concept is not really what people want. They want something else. So we've ended up with this sort of, I mean, I always call it the ugly sister of the Chipperas family, because obviously the Chipperas, I mean, let's call a spade, the Chipperas has three or four times as many listeners and viewers, and sure. You know, people really love the Chipperas. They, you know, there are people who enjoy the Lock-Ins too. And actually, hilariously, sometimes I meet people and they only know the Lock-In. They don't know the Chipperas at all, which blows my mind. But yeah, like there's always a negotiation between you and the audience, I think. And that's kind of sometimes missed. And, you know, a lot of poker content creators feel almost like that they're artists working in a secluded cave where they can do anything they want. And, you know, they're just going to put it out there. And if people don't like it, they don't like it. But if you put something out people don't like, now it has literally no value. And, you know, even great artists recognize that. You know, the example I always give is David Bowie. Bowie used to say that when he created the art, he just thought about, you know, creating whatever music he wanted, but in his mind it wasn't completed until it was out there and the audience reacted to it, and that was just as important as his input. But then other artists kind of just take the view of like, no, my art is my art and shouldn't be influenced in any way by anything anybody else says. Now that latter philosophy just doesn't work in the poker content space.
Yeah, I think maybe to come back to Felix on this one, you know, all I would say is there's only one James Bond, Felix, and clearly you're it, and people just want to watch that.
It's crazy, but we just realized that the numbers would drop immediately after I bust out of the tournament. It's crazy. Like, there's hundreds and 200 people dropping off the stream, not watching anymore. And when they come back, they will be asking in the chat, where's Felix? Is Felix Busto? Is he going back in? Does he take another bullet? And if I don't take another bullet, it's going to be, that's lame. So they're going to be really sad in the end, because they want to keep following the story. And it's crazy. Like, I think to what you said, Dara, is very interesting. Like, I'm always thinking about, do I want to put out what I think is good, or do I want to put out a mix between do I think what's good and what's needed or what's watched, what's being required by the people to watch? And then if I don't make the mix right, then I'm going to be unhappy or they're going to be unhappy. So it's a struggle. It's always like a struggle. And I feel like sometimes it's probably, it's like in a solver, like it's probably going to be a mix. It's going to be a mix on the GTO version. I don't know if it exists at all, or if it's just like a fine piece of art that you create and you just happen to hit the nerve of the audience. And you can be lucky if you do, and if you don't. I mean, all the stuff that we basically did always happened, or that I did, always happened by accident, or were shaped by by necessity. Like in a sense, there was a shift in legislation in the German market, which required me to switch to live poker. I didn't want to play live poker back then. I was like, no, actually, I want to stay back home at my computer and, you know, keep playing online poker. But I switched to live poker instead. And then I started and I tried it out and it grew on me. And I think people just loved watching the process of it growing on me, because in the beginning they were seeing, ah, no, he doesn't like it at all. And he just punts it off and he just plays very bad, to a more like better version. Like I think that people like to follow progress. People like to follow things that get better over time. That's probably what makes it worthwhile to watch.
Also, I think like your likability as well. I think that's something that even before I think we met years ago, but before we got to know each other, which was a few years ago,
yep.
There was a sense I always had, which is that you are, don't like, not to blow smoke up your ass or make you feel uncomfortable, but you're just like a really popular, friendly presence always. You know, I never heard anyone say a bad word about you. And I think in that sense, you're probably a really good Truman of the Truman Show that you make, in that like just people are just wanted, you know, root for you and naturally want to just like find out what right. you're doing and hope that it all works out. And just in case people don't know how well it worked out, I should give a little breakdown of Felix's recent result. He's second in Paris versus a massive field of 1,474 players, 5K buy-in, won €717,000. By far, yeah. I know, the biggest result of your career. Dara, for sure. We watched that one and we remarked throughout that the run, Felix seemed to be very, very either naturally or judiciously, if that's a word, judiciously, I've made it up anyway, very ICM aware. He was one of the shortest stacks from a few tables out, but just kept laddering. That's an important narrative, I think, to accentuate, right? I feel like too many players, quote, go for it. And I'm always reminded by something our very good pal Tom Hall said on this show years ago when he talked about showing that resilience and understanding the difference between decisions that maximize the money you will win rather than maximizing your chances of first.
Yep.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, that's super important. I mean, the whole narrative of like you play for the win, I don't know why that has taken on. I think that a lot of it is just laziness, or maybe harking back to a day where all you had to do was win a big sponsorship deal or you won a big sponsorship deal if you won a tournament. But, you know, I heard our friend Andy Wilson talking about this recently on another podcast. And Andy talked about it really eloquently about how like it's so important, but it's also misunderstood. You know, people often think ICM is just about laddering and playing tight when you're short and making folds because of pay jumps and so on. But there is the other side of ICM as well, which is that when you're the chip leader, you get to play super wide. And you kind of have to understand the full picture. And I was actually talking to a friend about this at the weekend, and he said that his favorite final table ever that he watched was when our friend Porrig O'Neill won EPT Prague. And the reason was not just that Porrig won, but that Porrig literally had every stack size at different points in that final table. He was the shorty. He was the chip leader. He was the guy who was second in chips getting put to the test by the chip leader. And Porrig put on a master display that day of how to play the different stack sizes. I think, the full picture of ICM that sometimes people miss. They just kind of oversimplify ICM to just like, oh yeah, you have to fold now because you're short.
Indeed, yeah. The tournament was ultimately won by Portugal's Jorge Abreu, who dominated the final day, it's fair to say, beginning with a commanding chip lead and maintaining control throughout. Felix, what did you make of Jorge's play throughout that final table? And I suppose, like, how much of your game was, like, navigating around him?
Yeah, I think back to what you said earlier about the ICM awareness and how I navigated through the final table was basically a lot credited to the work that I did with my coach before, because actually a couple hours before the final table started, he showed me some situations that might come up, like some short stack situations, some mid stack situations, and he showed me some simulations about it. And he basically gave me some ideas of what my strategies against different people at this table would be. And I think that really helped. I just remember three spots that he showed me on paper that actually occurred. And I was like, okay, I know what to do now. And this was like the key moment. This gave me so much confidence inside that I thought, hey, I've done the work. Yeah, you know, we've trained for this and now I know what to do. And I kind of felt like I played the different people in the correct way. So I stayed away from the people that I needed to stay away from. I played it cautiously against Jorge because he had one spot where I think he made two pair and I had like top pair with a flush draw. And I was happy that he didn't fire off on the river, because I would have called it off, and I would have looked into two pair. But apart from that, I think there were a lot of moments where I just felt like I'll just let Jorge do whatever he needs to do, and I'll just pick my spots wisely. And against him, I'll be cautious, but not too cautious. You know, I'll just take my chances when they arise. And when I flop something decent, I'll let him blast it off against me. I hope he blasts it off against me, which would have worked. But in the end, it came out in totally different ways that I wouldn't have imagined. Like, you know, him busting two people with ace-8 suited in one hand, or queen-10 winning against jacks from Coppola, and all these things. That was just... I just did what I had to do in some spots. I felt like I had to do. I made, I think, one big fold with ace queen against Coppola's ace king, which I usually wouldn't have made in any way. And that was just one single moment that it was just basically small little details that felt off to me, where I said to myself, you know, something feels off here. I'm just going to stay out of this situation. And it was the right call. I don't know why. It was like an intuition. It was a call of intuition. And I think, like, I sort of probably... It was a combination of a lot of lucky things coming together, but also me finding my way through these like little obstacles along the way. So that's how it felt to me, at least. So I'm not sure. It's always tough to say in poker, because you can always make a good story out of it when you go back in hindsight. Mm-hmm. But while you're grinding it, I just try to be as present as possible and just not think about anything that could happen in the future. I think that was the key. And I just let Abreu do his thing. So back to your question, I didn't even pay too much attention to him, to be honest. I just thought, you know, I need to stay. I didn't know too much about him before we started. I knew that Zeiss was obviously like, Casimir was a very strong online player, high stakes player. And I played a lot before with Jozonis. So I tried to stay away from them, and also Naza, the Ukrainian guy, is also very strong. I played with him a lot, and I just tried to stay away from these people. But Jorge, I just thought, like, let him do his thing. He's running well. He's playing well. I'll pick my spots, but it's going to work out. So that was the mindset.
Yeah, and it certainly did. Felix wasn't the only person on a big final table recently. And actually, the next story is about a man who made quite a few of them. He just went back to back in Vegas in the Poker Go studio. I'm, of course, talking about Brock Wilson here. Now, just to be clear, I'm not talking about two tournaments here back to back. I'm talking about two series wins back to back. Back in March, Brock won the Poker Go Cup. He had two victories in that series, propelling him to the title. This time around, it was the US Poker Open, and once again he won two tournaments outright, which, you know, got him lots of leaderboard points, which took down the overall festival leaderboard. Last week's results brought his tally to 13.3 million in live winnings, most of which have come since 2018. And his main rival, actually, for the US Poker Open down the home straight was his girlfriend Cherish Andrews. Andrews has 4.5 million in lifetime winnings, 3.8 million of which have come since 2021, so she's been basically crushing for quite a while. Dara, these two are making waves and giving the Foxens a run for their money as poker super couple right now. Or wait, will that always be a title held by Gentili and Phil Lack?
Yeah, it depends on how you measure these things, I guess. I have to say, I don't know much about Cherish at all. I don't think I've ever played with her. But I did play with Brock a few times at the WSOP last year, and I was incredibly impressed by him. Didn't know who he was at the time. But I remember saying to my friend Thurlock that he was playing very well. There was a couple of things which stood out in my mind which made him different from sort of other American rigs I played against. One was that he was much more deliberate at the table, thinking through spots. I think there's like a culture in America of live poker has to be fast, and the regs kind of play along with that. But Brock was very thoughtful and studious in every pot he was playing in, basically, which, as I said, made him quite atypical for an American rig. And then he was just playing so well. Like, he was using sizings that you just don't see live, but are very much a product of somebody who has clearly been in the lab and studying with solvers, which, again, you know, talk down on the Americans too much, but a lot of the Americans really just kind of play in a very standard way. You know, they raise a lot pre-flop, way wider than they're supposed to. They bet bet one third a pot on almost every flop, and there's not much, there's not a lot of variation there. But yeah, no, he was doing all the funky stuff that you're supposed to do, like, you know, betting 1.5 times pot on flops where that is a thing, and betting 10% on other flops. So he really stood out in my mind as somebody, and I remember talking to Turlough McHugh about him, and Turlough had also played with him, and Turlough is a massive Brock fanboy. Like, he just thinks Brock is maybe the best player he's ever played with. So not too surprising to me that he's gone on this run. And as you say, this is much more impressive than just winning two tournaments. That can happen to anybody. And it always kind of annoys me when people marvel at that, because essentially it's just marveling at variance or randomness for the most part. But I do think Brock is a cut above the fields that he plays in. Now, that said, you know, Poker Go fields are a lot smaller, so it is more possible. It's certainly easier to win two Poker Go, be player of the series at two Poker Go series than it is at, say, two EPTs or two WSOPs. But nevertheless, yeah, Brock is really impressive player. Not surprised to see him getting the success.
Yeah, not surprised at all. I couldn't agree more with all of that. Felix, I met your girlfriend in Dublin last month at the Irish Open. I'm interested to know, does she play, and would you be interested in trying to maybe form a European or German version of this sort of poker super couple?
Well, I don't know yet. I have taken her to a poker seminar of a friend of mine who is a poker coach in Germany, and he's very famous for that. You can book like his coachings for companies and stuff like this. So she came to a company for that, and I was sort of like a second teacher to his coachings, and we were attending the seminar, and she really enjoyed it, and she played very well. Also, she is very good at reading my bluffs, so that's something that works very well. And she's also very good at bluffing herself, so she's got all the requirements. But let's see. I mean, I took her to a couple of stops, and she hasn't played a tournament yet. But who knows? She's able to, and I'll ask her again if she wants to try, and if she wants to, who knows? Who knows what's going to happen?
Good stuff, good stuff. Well, from one Wilson to another, and actually Dara foreshadowed this one a little bit. Andy Wilson just did a phenomenal interview on a recent episode of the Mechanics of Poker podcast entitled "The Dark Side of Being Staked." I must admit, I get is there a new phrase we can coin here? Pod envy, when somebody does a really good interview and it wasn't us, Dara, and then I have to listen to someone else doing a better interview than we did, and I'm like, oh God, I really wish we'd given that one. That's a really nice one. On this episode, Andy talked about his 200K downswing. Actually, Dara and I haven't watched this one actually, but I am keen, and it's got incredible reviews. I am planning to watch the whole thing. Sorry, I should be clear here. I've seen bits of it because loads of it's all over the internet, but I just haven't watched it all the way through. It's quite long. I'm planning to do that on my Monte Carlo week, but I want to know, because I know you have listened to it. Can you talk about what is being described as a refreshing, how do I put it here? Like, blast of reality, and I suppose a look behind the curtain of what it's really like to endure really big downswings.
Yeah, well, first of all, I wouldn't feel too bad about, you know, the pod envy thing. We've had Andy on a few times, and he always has given us sensational interviews too. But this is a very different format. You know, this was more than 2 hours long. Now, that's what actually stopped me from listening to it at the start, because I'm not a fan of these long, rambling, old school Joey Ingram type podcasts where Federer Hulse says something interesting in the first 30 minutes, and then they spend 4 hours hanging out by the hot tub, and you're
Gummies.
why was this even included? So I was afraid that this might be the case with this one, but it absolutely is not the case. And so many people who I really respect their opinions told me, no, you have to listen to this. I did. I listened to every second. It's absolutely dense with just great intelligent viewpoints, information on poker, how poker really works, I think is the thing that comes across. And Andy is just incredibly articulate and intelligent on all of this stuff. One thing we're all guilty of, and we're guilty of this too, and I appreciate the irony. You know, we have Felix on now, in part because he came second in an EPT recently. When you listen to the Chip Race or other podcasts, or you observe poker media, you tend to only hear about the winners, the recent winners, and you can get the impression that everybody's winning. And of course, that's not true at all in tournament poker particularly. There are more people on downswings at any one time than people who've won something big recently. And this was a very refreshing antidote to that, where Andy talked about his really bad downswing, you know, 1,000 buy-in downswing. And, you know, this was at a stage where Andy was already a top-class player, and you wouldn't expect a player of his caliber to drop 1,000 buy-ins playing $200 tournaments online, but he did, and he was very open about it and how he had to struggle with it and how he was able to get through it and all that stuff. And I think that's stuff that people who are going through a downswing themselves need to hear, because it is very difficult to deal with downswings, and it's not it's it's a much overlooked topic. You know, I know from my own social media, people don't like when you moan. So, you know, I don't moan about beats, I don't moan about downswings, but people love when you win. So, you know, I can maybe I haven't won something for a while, and then I put up a tournament win, and you know, it immediately gets 200 likes on Twitter. And that's, you know, that's kind of nice that people are that way. But the downside of that is that you can get a very false impression of poker that everybody is winning, and then if you're playing and you're not winning, you can feel, well, what's wrong with me? And it actually exacerbates that. Now, above and beyond how to deal with downswings, the whole thing was just really good, well thought out. There's a lot of advice from Andy on how to get better, how to study, how he got better. There was advice on staking as well, which I know is something that people always want. But one thing which really resonated with me was the interviewers probed him on like how much work he'd put into it, and he, you know, he came from an e-game, Trackmania, where he was one of the top five in the world, and he had put a similar amount into poker. And they asked him, like, is it obsession or is it compulsion? And this is something which I've been asked about in the past as well. You know, I always regard myself as obsessive rather than compulsive. And he made one point which I always make, that I don't think it's compulsion, because I can actually stop. If you have a compulsion, I don't think you can stop. But if you really just really enjoy something and you keep doing it, then that's more obsession than compulsion. But the other point which Andy made, which I had never thought about, was that it's people who have a compulsion are focused on outcomes, and people who have obsession are focused on process. So obsessive poker players just love the process of poker, love playing poker, they love everything around it, they love studying it, they love the strategy aspect. That makes them obsessive. People who have you know, compulsive gamblers, they're focusing on, I want to win, I want to get back the money I've lost, I need to win a tournament, I need to end this downswing, etc., etc. And something I never thought about, but it does make perfect sense. And this is also circling back to how you deal with downswings. If you have that sort of obsessive personality where you are focusing on process rather than outcome, it does make it easier to go, okay, well, the outcomes haven't been good recently, but so long as I stick with the process, and I enjoy the process, then I'll get through this.
Absolutely. And over to you on this, Felix. Actually, you know, obviously we have given appropriately a decent bit of time to your fantastic success and the story of sort of how you went from, you know, $50 deposits and sort of spinning it up to a four-figure roll, five-figure roll, and now obviously, you know, EPT almost champion. But any memorable swings along the way, any nasty self-doubt that crept in? Can you relate to, I suppose, as well, what Andy did say in that interview I saw on the clips, that sort of get back on the horse mentality or attitude?
While you were talking there, I could resonate a lot with what you said, and you as well, before you said about the downswings, because I've been recently talking about it on a live stream and some content that I produced also, that I was thinking along the way there were so many phases and stretches where I was so close to giving up and so close to just throwing it all in the bin and just thinking, why am I actually doing this? That you're questioning yourself, you're questioning your self-worth, you're questioning your abilities, you're questioning the whole game, you're questioning pretty much everything. And this is something that I've come to realize over the 20 years that I've been playing poker, that there is a room for this, and that there has to be a room for this, because if this can't be there, then the positive side of things, that you can actually believe in yourself, that you can do it, and that you actually then finally doing it can't exist, because you have to have these like antagonists, as sort of, I don't know how, in a better way to put it, but I feel like I've been through so many stages in cash games and tournaments where I thought I would never get out. I would never be able to recover. It would always continue like this, and you always go down this path once you've started, because you start to always. I mean, it's always a combination of things. You're starting to lose because of certain setups or bad card runs, and then you start to make some adjustments to your game. You over-adjust. You get a little bit too aggressive. You get a little bit too passive. You tilt a little here. You start to play a little bit worse. So it's all like a spiral, and it's very, very tough to get out of this. So I think this is also something to address way more. that this is also something which is normal, but it's tough to accept. But once I started to accept that it actually happens and that I'm in the middle of it, and you stop saying to yourself, you can't be, because you're supposed to be a professional, you're supposed to be a good content creator, you're supposed to achieve something, you're supposed to blah, blah, blah. And once you stop letting that go, I think it's an absolution. Like, it's sort of like a way to say it's okay. It's okay that it goes like this, but it's going to pass. It's going to pass. At some point, you're going to think of it and you're thinking it was just a stage during the whole process. When you say you zoom out of this graph and you zoom in, like, you see these little downswings, but when you zoom out, it goes up again and then down again and up again, but you don't see the dents. You just see the line. So, and that's what I come to realize after Paris, that it's been a 20-year process, and everything that I went through was okay to go through, because it taught me something. It got me more motivation, actually. It's funny now that I think of it, the more downswings I had, the more motivated I actually got. Like, as you say, Dara, it's like this obsessive mindset where you think, no, I'm not going to let this push me down. I'm just going to keep going. And at some point, it's going to stop and I'm going to turn it around. It's not a compulsion. It's like you want to see, you believe, you have self-doubt, but you also believe in yourself. It's like, the two things can exist at the same time. That's what I came to learn.
Yeah. And actually, Felix, I'm starting to realize I made kind of a poor reference earlier. I called you like Truman on your own Truman show. But actually, the reality of that show is that, you know, he doesn't know he's on a show and he's just sort of living his life. He certainly, okay, gets suspicious at one point. But you voluntarily put your life on show. So I wonder, like, in the context of a game where there's going to be swings, there's going to be hardships, there's going to be disappointment. Of course, there's going to be these moments of joy and ecstasy when great things happen too. But, there's more negative experiences, you know, on the daily grind of poker than there is positive ones, even if those positive ones overshadow the negative ones by a factor to make it financially better for you. So I'm just interested then, do you feel like by putting yourself in front of a camera for all of that, for warts and all of that experience, has put more pressure on you? Or is it in some way less pressure because you have an audience who can understand it because they've been living vicariously through you?
Also, very interesting question. And I don't really know how to answer, because it can go both ways. And I've experienced both ways. Like, there have been stretches where I've been super hard pressured by both the audience and all the other people that were watching me. Like, I mean, it's not only the people that are watching me. It's also like when you go to EPTs, it's other players. It's also like people from the staff that you get friendly with. It's your sponsors. It's your partners. It's the people that are watching you. It's everybody sort of puts an expectation on you because in the spotlight, and they're expecting something of you, of course. I mean, you can put up a show and still not deliver this is the thing about poker. You can put up the best show, you can put up the best strategy, the best plays, but you're still not going to win. And it doesn't matter if you believe that it's the right thing. Like, from the outside perspective, people that are watching you are people that have expectations of you. They will think otherwise. They will have their own thoughts about it. They will think, I don't agree with this play. I don't think he should have done this. I think you should do this. So it's tough, and it's probably taught me that both ways are possible. It can be an enhancing experience, but it can also be a very, very, like, it can pull you down. So what I've probably learned best with this is just to stay level-headed throughout everything, like even the highs and the lows. When it's going really well, I'm trying to say to myself, you know, recently come to this quote that I really like, that this too shall pass. Like, if I win, this too shall pass. If I lose, this too shall pass. Everybody has their opinion, so my job is basically to learn to not care what the other people think of what I'm doing. All that matters is what I think, if I'm doing the right thing, or my coach, basically, because that's the person that I trust most about, you know, watching my game and trying to help me improve. But yeah, it's tough. So I couldn't really find a good answer to your question. It can go both ways, and I've experienced both, and it's extremes. It's tough. Definitely.
Well, your failure to answer the question was a very entertaining answer, so I appreciate that.
Thanks.
Let's end things with a little look ahead to EPT Monte Carlo, where you're obviously under loads and loads of pressure now, Felix. There will be not only a 5K main event, there's a 1615 Open, there's an 825 Cup, but there's also a bunch of high rollers, including a couple of live stream super high rollers, the 100K One Drop and the 250K event. Now, Felix, are you tempted? I know you've been studying up these past few weeks.
To be honest, we actually put up the April Fool's joke that I'm going to play at 100K. I actually liked it. And then once I put it up, I'm like, I might just try to do it just for the taxes. Why not?
Very good. Very good.
No, I'm not planning to, but I mean, we might definitely, we've done it before. We might definitely cover it here and there if there's some interesting players and some interesting spots. Like there's Germans sometimes playing it. We know Leon Sturm, we like him. Samuel Mulua, if they're playing, we're probably going to sweat with them. But me personally, I'm just going to try to win a trophy for once. And I think the best chance to win a trophy is probably in the smaller buy-ins.
Well, I spoke to fellow Poker Stars ambassador Jason Kuhn, who I know is looking forward to these tournaments. And I also spoke with our player liaison, who said that the list of big name players attending is absolutely stacked. So I think it's going to be pretty cool having those things, not just on the schedule, but on the live stream as well. Dara, I know you don't watch a huge amount of live event coverage, not really your thing, but you do like to watch a bit of nosebleed Triton action. And this will certainly be in that category. As a coach, how high up do you rate the watching of elite players doing battle like that? Should it be part of a healthy poker player's regimen?
Yeah, I actually had a discussion with this yesterday with a new student who asked me that very question. And my answer was that absolutely it can play a very big part, but it tends to be at a later stage. When you're learning poker initially, it's much more important to just learn the game fundamentally yourself. And, you know, I always talk about the three pillars, GTO, exploits, and ICM. And once you have mastered those, you know, once you understand how the game is supposed to work, how it works in practice against real life opponents, and then how ICM changes everything at the end of tournaments or around bubbles, then it can be very good to watch sort of like the best in the world playing. It's a good way to learn exploits, for example. You know, often those fields are mixed. You have some of the best players in the world, and you have some businessmen as well who are not playing at the same level. And just the way that the elite players go about sort of exploiting the weaker players can be very helpful. But, you know, I coach some guys who do play at a very high level. And one thing I've noticed is that once they get to that stage, that sort of becomes the major part of their study. They just watch big final tables, both live and online. You know, the PokerStars replay is great for this. You can watch the best players in the world when they make a final table and see what they do. And they're looking for things which surprise them. You know, Lena does something which they're like, oh, I would never have done that. I wonder why he's doing that. And then they try and reverse engineer it. And, you know, maybe they work with a solver or they ask their friends or they try and come to a solution as to why Lena is doing what he's doing, and then that could be a new trick that they have as well, or a new exploit that they've learned. I think it is a great way to learn, but you know, it's definitely not for everyone. If you're struggling to beat ABI $20 online, you should really not be focusing too much on what the guys are doing in Tritons. You just want to get fundamentally good yourself, so that you can beat your own level comfortably. But you know, at some future point where you have figured out all that stuff, then it becomes a great way to learn for sure.
Great advice. As usual, well, a reminder that on Sunday, May 3rd, there will be the final table of the 100K. On Monday and Tuesday, that's the 4th and 5th of May, the 250K will be televised the whole way through. And then from that point on, Wednesday onward, EPT main event coverage will be going, I think, from day two coverage onwards. I certainly hope to be in the booth for lots of this alongside James Hardigan, Nick Walsh, and for the final time, Joe Stapleton, who this week announced that he will be leaving PokerStars and EPT after, I think, 17, maybe more, maybe 18 years of broadcasts. Excellent poker writer. Shout out to Chuck Sklar, who penned a very nice piece for PokerAddy about Joe and his tenure at Stars and EPT. He said, I understand he's going to be focusing on his stand-up and later this year standing up at the altar where he marries his fiance. Next thing you know, they'll be saying Joe's signature line, hello, my babies, to actual babies. Felix, you've been in the Poker Stars team with Joe for a long, long time. What can you say about his time at Stars?
I said it in the group chat where we're all part of, where I just think like it's a glitch in the matrix. I can't fathom this. I can't really imagine the broadcast without Joe, because the jokes are just so, it's just, I think from being a commentator myself and running this live stream that I do, and also having a lot of people from our community, both experts and people that are super poker enthusiasts, but also entertaining, just on a level, not like too super technical and too strategical, more like on the light entertainment side of things. I think this is what a good poker stream needs. Like, it's a mix and a balance of a lot of people that bring in a little lightheartedness in the middle of a lot of tough strategy. And I think he's just a stellar example of how you can do that and how you can manage it. And at the same time, still be professional about the poker, because he's also, you know, he learns a lot through all the commentators that they're with him. And I just feel like he's a super fun guy, and he brings all the lighthearted entertainment to the stream. And I just can't imagine what it's going to be like. So I think it's going to be a new chapter, and I'm excited to see it. And I'm just going to miss all the quotes that you got used to, because this is what, because we talked about this is what Twitch culture and what live streaming culture is about, like building a story and building like a connection with people. And I think like Hello My Babies, or like Your Band, or Everyone Loves a Chop Pot, all these things, you know, it's just, this is just what makes the program worthwhile to watch, because people come back for these insiders, and these, like, they feel more connected this way. So I think it's going to be a new chapter and a new era, and everything has to be built in a new way, but I'm excited to see it. I'm also wishing Joe the best, and I'm going to miss him. That's all I can say.
Indeed. And Darrow, Joe's voice is synonymous with EPT coverage. He and James have been a duo for so, so long. I did reach out to Joe right after the news broke, but I also reached out to James because I imagine it's super weird for him too, as someone who is associated as part of a broadcasting duo with yourself. It made me think about his side of it as well. James is obviously such a pro, but your thoughts on what this might feel like for him?
Yeah, I mean, in fact, funny, when this news broke, the first person I thought about was James. It was like, well, what's, you know, it's like when you hear about a divorce, you immediately think about the kids. And it kind of felt that way too. Like, you know,
we're the kids. We're all the audience. We're the kids.
Yeah, we kind of played with that when, you know, when we signed with Stars and Paddy for a while, by pretending that we were splitting up as well. And it actually upset a lot of people. It didn't feel right. So it was like James and Joe are just synonymous now in people's minds. And Joe in particular is like an institution in poker, or he's actually a bunch of institutions. On the one hand, he's something like a hall of fame in terms of all the people he can get in, but he's also like, sometimes it's like what he's drawing out is like a mental institution. All the patients are escaping and just there's absolute mayhem in the booth. So he brings all of that stuff, his huge personality to commentary. Now, I, for one, I don't believe that he's riding off into the sunset to have babies. You know, I've seen the story before. I remember when Negreanu left Stars, we got a video, I think he was on a boat or something for some reason, talking about how he was taking a step back and he was going to go off and have babies. And then 6 months later, he signed with GG and they forgot all about that. I feel there's going to be something big in the future for Joe as well. But I do feel sorry for James. You know, if somebody did split us up and we suddenly had to deal with new partners, it would feel weird for sure. But, you know, James is also a very versatile commentator. He can kind of do the everyman role. He's the kind of guy that you can put in the box and he can do whatever role is required of him. Whereas, you know, Stapes is more like Stapes is Stapes, and Stapes always had to be Stapes. He had the more fixed personality. So I think James will be okay. That's the short answer. But Joe would definitely be missed. Like, he has so many ardent fans who literally associate EPT coverage and Stars coverage in general with his voice, with all of his jokes, with all of his running jokes, his catchphrases, all that stuff.
Indeed, indeed. Well, look, it is time we wrap things up. Shout out to Joe. Obviously, we will hear from him one more time in the booth in Monte Carlo. I hope you'll tune into all those streams that I mentioned. Felix, a huge thank you for stopping by today. Unfortunately, this too has also passed. I will see you in Monte Carlo.
Thank you guys for having me. That was a lot of fun. See you in Monte Carlo.
And Darrow, thank you so much as well.
Yeah, I won't see either of you in Monte Carlo. I'll be doing the monster instead. But I'll be thinking of you guys, and hopefully, what get to grill one of you on a final table.
Great stuff, great stuff. Thanks again.